Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So I think it's hard for anybody not to notice that the most important thing for both parties in the United States is to send as much money as humanly possible to Ukraine. And I think many people are confused about why this seems to be the top priority of all American politicians, whether they be on the left or the right. And so Ben Swan is with me today. He is the creator of a new documentary about the Ukraine war and Vladimir Zelensky. And I wanted to talk to him about all of this background because I think it's fascinating. I think a lot of people don't understand what's actually happening in that country. Ben, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So a lot of people, I think, look at this war and they're very confused because, you know, I'm like a lot of, I think, classic American, especially conservatives on the right. We saw Russia and we said, man, that's USSR, right? That's the bad guys. I'm pretty on board with these guys, you know, being the people that we've done battle with for a long time. It's not hard to understand why they might be the belligerents in some kind of conflict. But the longer we go into this, the more it seems like that moral black and white is very confusing. It seems like maybe the story we've been told is not as obvious. And that doesn't mean that Russia isn't doing something bad or that Vladimir Putin isn't a bad guy. But it seems like there are far more interests involved than just the ones that have been described to us by our leaders.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And look, the reality is this. You are correct when you say, especially as Americans who have grown up kind of post-Cold War, we still have that the remnants of that, right? We still view the world through the lens of Rocky IV. We're the good guys, and then there's these bad guys who are almost, you know, unbeatable, it seems like, and yet we'll pull it off in the end. And so we have this cosmic battle between Russia and the U.S., East, West. It's a very easy narrative to sell. And I'm with you, right? When the war starts, it's very easy to say, hey, it's very clear Russia's bad and Ukraine, they're smaller and they're little and they're being attacked. And so we've got to stand, as we always say, right, with democracy. The problem is the longer you watch what's happening, the more you see that actually Ukraine's not a democracy. And whatever they were before Zelensky took power, they've become less and less and less of a democracy during that time. In fact, I would argue that everything we say that we're trying to prevent Vladimir Putin from doing to Ukraine is actually what Vladimir Zelensky is doing to Ukraine. He's the one who's oppressing Ukraine. He's the one who's getting rid of political parties. He's the one who's shutting down the church, arresting leaders of the church, banning media in that country, no freedom of speech, locking up journalists. What's happening there is absolutely wild. And the biggest problem with it is that our media here, politicians, and of course Hollywood, are all on the same side. Now listen, you and I are probably going to share at least in one view throughout this conversation today. Whenever you get politicians, you get big media, and you get Hollywood all on the same side, they're probably on the wrong side.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever I see every politician in the United States saying the same thing simultaneously, I really start to worry about what's going on. All right, well, I definitely want to dive into, especially, I think, the background of what is happening in Ukraine. I think most people don't understand the history and some of the circumstances on the ground that led to this war. And I think once you have that perspective, it really helps people grasp then what's happening now. But before we dive into that, guys, let me tell you really quickly about ISI. Universities today aren't just neglecting real education, they're actively undermining it, and we can't let them get away with it. America was made for an educated and engaged citizenry. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute is here to help. ISI offers programs and opportunities for conservative students across the country. ISI understands that conservatives and right-of-center students feel isolated on college campuses and that you're often fighting for your own reputation, dignity, and future. Through ISI, you can learn about what Russell Kirk called the permanent things, the philosophical and political teachings that shaped and made Western civilization great. ISI offers many opportunities to jumpstart your career. They have fellowships at some of the nation's top conservative publications like National Review, The American Conservative, and The College Thinker. If you're a graduate student, ISI offers funding opportunities to sponsor the next great generation of college professors. Through ISI, you can work with conservative thinkers who are making a difference. Thinkers like Chris Rufo, who currently has an ISI researcher helping him with his book. But perhaps most importantly, ISI offers college students a community of people that can help them grow. If you're a college student, ISI can help you start a student organization or a student newspaper, or meet other like-minded students at their various conferences and events. ISI is here to educate the next generation of great Americans. To learn more, go to isi.org. That's isi.org. All right, Ben. So like I said, I want to go over a little bit of the history here. Everyone remembers, I think, watching that Tucker Carlson interview where Vladimir Putin went on this long diatribe of kind of explaining the history of Russia. A lot of people fell asleep in the middle there. But I do think this is critical, at least to get a little bit of that story, because without that context, it's hard for people to grasp what's going on. Many people look at, you know, nations today and they think, okay, you draw a line on a map and the people inside the map are part of the nation. And that's just how nations work. And that's how they've always worked. But that's actually a relatively new thing for people. Mm-hmm. And so if you just understand the world this way, then you look at what happened between Ukraine and Russia and you say, oh, well, yeah, Russia just went in there and randomly invaded a sovereign country. And there's just no context to it. But I think if we understand the history leading up to that, it makes a little more sense as why Russia would feel compelled to involve themselves in Ukrainian affairs. Could you give us a little bit of history of what the country looked like before Zelensky came to power?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how you started here talking about the Putin thing, right? Because, listen, very impressive. I was very impressed by the fact that he was able to rattle off the history that he was. At the same time, you know, again, if you're a Westerner, if you're here in the U.S., you're like, okay. Yeah, right. The crazy thing is this. I didn't know until we started this project that 300 years ago, give or take, that the capital of Russia was Kiev, right? It wasn't even Moscow or St. Petersburg. It was Kiev. The reality is that this region of the world, Ukraine, Russia, it's been one region for a long time. And then there's been autonomy and there's, you know, as has been explained, I think, in other interviews, there's been autonomy. There's been times when, you know, the term Ukraine, I guess, doesn't mean a country. It means people who live to the east or whatever, something like that. But here's the history that I think a lot of people don't know. And the reality is that under the Soviet Union, right, you had the very blurred lines, not just between Russia and Ukraine, but Georgia and all these different satellite states, right, of the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union dissolved around 1990, 1991, we end up in this situation where all of a sudden you do draw lines on a map and say, okay, this is now a new country. Russia is now here. Ukraine is here. Georgia is here. You know, Azerbaijan is here. Armenia is here. And so you're drawing out all these different spots on the map. But the reality is that Ukraine itself is a fairly interesting story, because Ukraine is really divided into two parts, Eastern Ukraine and Western Ukraine. And for Americans who don't understand that, I would say, think back to after World War II, when you had East Germany and West Germany, right? One was controlled by the West and one was controlled by the Soviet Union. Well, the difference with Ukraine is Western Ukraine are more Ukrainians, but Eastern Ukraine are mostly Russians, meaning Russian-speaking people from birth, right? That's what the language they're taught. Most people in Eastern Ukraine identify as Russians. They fly Russian flags. One thing we did not know until we started this process is that Vladimir Zelensky himself is actually a Russian speaker from birth. He did not speak Ukrainian until he ran for president. He actually took a crash course and learned to speak Ukrainian. He actually was a Russian speaker. And so this is not an unusual thing. The near history tells us something pretty remarkable, which is that back in 2014 or so, Ukraine, as this autonomous country, which again is only about 30, 40 years old as a country, is in the midst of having a presidential election. And, you know, around 2014, there's a coup after a recent election. And a guy named Viktor Yanukovych becomes president of Ukraine. He had long been kind of vying for this position. The IMF comes in and says, hey, we want to make a bunch of loans to your country and make Ukraine rich. And then Russia comes in and says, wait, before you start taking money from the IMF, before you start taking it from the U.S., take it from us instead. And Yanukovych preferred to take money from Putin. Well, when that happened, there was a coup. We all know about the coup, right? I hope people know. Maybe Americans don't know.
I think a lot of people don't, actually, yeah.
Yeah, there was a huge coup in 2014. It was run by the same people who helped push the Iraq War. Victoria Nuland, who was the Undersecretary of State at the time, goes into to Ukraine, and they helped to foment a coup. It's called a color revolution. And the government is overthrown, right? And these radical groups take over, and the U.S. and the EU install a new president. Petro Poroshenko, and they install this guy. And the problem was that Yanukovych, who gets run out, right, is pushed out of the country, is no longer in power. And the U.S. says, oh, look, it's a fight for democracy. Well, listen, that's not democracy, right? The U.S. going in and overthrowing another country because we don't like who he's going to take money from, the president's going to take money from, is not democracy. But we run him out. He's out of power. And then Ukraine falls apart. It struggles for the next few years. But simultaneously, as it's struggling, there is also a civil war going on. Because in 2014, you might have heard, as a listener, you might have heard about a place called Crimea. It's a peninsula to the east of Ukraine, down around the Black Sea. This peninsula has a referendum in 2014. The people there vote. It's like 88-89% of the people vote to leave Ukraine and to join Russia. Right? Very controversial. Even today, we hear a lot of politicians say, back when Russia stole or annexed this part of Ukraine. Well, they didn't steal it. The people there voted. Why would they do that? Why would they want to be a part of Russia? Because they were 90% Russian speaking. They fly Russian flags and they identify as Russians. There's also a region to the east, which people have probably heard some of these terms. It's called the Donbas region, which is in the east of Ukraine, which borders Russia. The vast majority of those people speak Russian, identify as Russians. What Americans have not been told, even though this information has been out there, it's not been readily told in our media, is that there has been a civil war going on in that region since 2014. For 10 years now, there's been a civil war in this region. And it's people who are identified as Russians, but they live in Ukraine, who say, we don't want to be a part of Ukraine. And so the Ukrainian military and militia groups have been shelling and bombing that region of Ukraine now for almost 10 years. And thousands of people have died in this civil war. So back in 2019, there's a presidential election that's gearing up, and a candidate comes along who happens also to be a TV star. We've heard that story before, right? A guy who was on TV and all of a sudden he's never been in office and runs for president and gets elected. Well, it happened in Ukraine. The guy's name was Vladimir Zelensky. He was on a TV show about a guy who was a teacher who accidentally, you know, is caught ranting about government corruption on video. And so he gets elected and becomes president of Ukraine. Well, this actually plays out in real life. In the show is called The Servant of the People. The guy who was the star of the show, Vladimir Zelensky, 2 years after this show becomes a huge hit, files a political party and creates a political party named after the TV show, The Servant of the People Party. And then the Servant of the People Party candidate, Zelensky, runs for president. And guess what he runs on? He runs as a pro-peace candidate who guarantees he will end the civil war in the Donbas region and he'll have peace with Russia. And because of that, he receives this landslide victory and becomes president of the country. That's the kind of the short history of how we get to Zelensky in power.
Yeah, it sounds like a Black Mirror episode where you have this hyper reality and they plan out his ascension to the presidency by having him play the president beforehand so everyone's kind of prepared for that. But yeah, I think it's really important for people to understand that this war is not isolated. It's actually nested inside of several other conflicts. It's connected to these, and mm-hmm. it's a result of that. And I think without that understanding, you don't understand the impetus for some of these moves. But I think it's also important for people to understand the tension here. You know, Samuel Huntington in Clash of Civilizations identified Ukraine as a civilizational buffer, a flashpoint that would create the clash between the West and the Russian Empire, or you know, what is now functionally the Russian Empire, because of this, the tensions you're describing. Now, Huntington got it wrong. He thought that they would work this out without a war, and obviously that wasn't the case. But these tensions are longstanding. He was writing about them in 1992, and they weren't really resolved even up to this point. And I think a lot of people will look at, you know, Ukraine and say, well, why wouldn't they want to be part of the IMF? Why wouldn't they want to be part of NATO? Why is it a problem for Russia for them to join these global organizations? I don't understand why they can't make that decision. And I think as people who, you know, basically live inside the global American empire, it's hard for us to understand that these organizations are extensions of that. And so another empire, another civilization in this class of civilizations, not model, would see the buffer states joining that as a serious threat to their sovereignty.
Oh, 100%. You know, one thing that I thought was very interesting about the Tucker Carlson interview was when Vladimir Putin talked about asking Bill Clinton if Russia could join NATO in the 1990s. I thought that was, of all the things he talked about historically, that was the most interesting thing to me. And the reason that's so interesting is because you have to understand, folks, that NATO as an organization, right, only exists for one purpose: to hold the Soviet Union in check. That was the entire creation of NATO. That was its objective from the very beginning. NATO actually lost its purpose when the Soviet Union fell. When the Cold War came to an end, NATO's entire point of existence was no longer there, right? And so they stumbled around in the dark for a while, trying to figure out what are we going to do? And they created, you know, the Atlantic Council, and they created these different groups that were supposed to be about, well, we're gonna fight cyber terrorism, or we're gonna fight against cyber wars, right? They started trying to come up with some other mission, and then they eventually abandoned that to go back to, we need to stop Russia, right? That's how they kind of refound their purpose. What's fascinating about NATO, though, is that when when the Soviet Union collapsed and NATO no longer had a purpose, one of the promises that was made to Russia at the time for letting go of all these satellite states and all these territories was NATO will no longer move. The quote was, will not move one inch to the east from where it was at the time. Since then, NATO's more than tripled in size. Right, it keeps adding countries, and those countries it adds are to the east. It keeps adding countries closer and closer and closer to Russia. And the red line for Russia has long been that you cannot make Ukraine a part of NATO. Why? Because Ukraine borders NATO. I'll give you a geographic example, right? If the Chinese said, we're going to adopt satellite states that are going to join us in any kind of military operation to control and even to hold back the United States. And they were doing this all around the world, picking different countries. They're on the verge of doing it, by the way. But this is what they were doing. And then all of a sudden they said, we found a new country we want to join our alliance to suppress the United States. It's Mexico. Do you think we'd be okay with that? We'd be okay with them saying, we're going to move missiles and missile defense systems, and we're going to move military weapons into Mexico in order to hold back the United States. It's not because we would ever attack the United States. We just want to make sure that the U.S. stays where it's supposed to be and doesn't bother anyone else in the world. Well, I don't think Americans would be okay with that. I think we'd have a huge problem with that, and I don't think we'd allow that to happen. And yet that's exactly what's been happening with Ukraine.
Yeah, we don't even need a hypothetical for that. This is the entirety of the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? Yeah. Like this we almost came to the edge of a nuclear world war for exactly this reason. And NATO's a strange organization, of course, because it's been admitting things like Turkey, which are already kind of at war with other pieces of NATO. It's a very strange alliance, which kind of brings a questions about why it continues, and probably one of the reasons that Donald Trump became very unpopular with much of kind of the defense apparatus when he questioned if NATO was still necessary, and, you know, why aren't these other countries paying their dues? Is this even something we need anymore? Those are questions you're not really supposed to ask, I think, at this point. And I think that brings me to my next question. You know, I remember leftists really liking the Soviet Union. They loved Russia, couldn't get enough of it. You know, at every point, it was America that was the aggressor, and, you know, ridiculous that we would continue to treat the Soviet Union as this evil empire. You know, the very phrase from Ronald Reagan, the evil empire, was a terrible thing. And today it seems like they're all super on board with this. There's no problem. I mean, even places like the State Department, which is no bastion of right-wing thought, seems to be very motivated to eliminate Russia. So why were all these people who used to be very pro-Russia, or at least very tolerant of Russia, all of a sudden feel this drive to basically wipe it off the map, or at the very least pin it into a corner?
Well, so I guess where I would approach that is to say that I think there's a misnomer there about what forces are doing this. I don't think it's so much that it's the left that's doing it. I think it's that if you take the political factions that exist in America, right, from MAGA over to, you know, the far left progressives, there's a big space in the middle there of what I would say are establishment neocon, now neoliberals. Neocons have almost gone away. Mm-hmm. They almost don't exist anymore. What they've done is they've just shifted on that scale, and they're now all neoliberals. And so the same people that we might have thought, you know, years ago of being a neocon, a couple of names that would come to mind, John Bolton, right? Is John Bolton really a neocon, or is he now a neoliberal? And has he just slid on this scale because all of a sudden the same people who hated John Bolton years ago now praise him? I mean, of all the places he would get praised, places like The View, right? When Sonny Hostin and Whoopi Goldberg are on the side of John Bolton, it makes you wonder, is he influencing them, or is he actually just on the sliding scale? And so I think what's actually happened is that these neocons don't exist anymore, because essentially what Trump did was he forced them out of the Republican Party. And by growing a new form of Republicanism, which is what he's done, and bringing in MAGA, MAGA has pushed out neocons. There's no room for neocons in the Republican Party anymore. And so they've all kind of become neoliberals now. They call themselves Republicans, but they're not Republicans. They're liberals, and not in the traditional sense either, right? The true sense of a liberal is someone who believes in freedom of speech and allows people to live their lives and civil liberties. They don't believe in that either, right? They're this different kind of form of neoliberalism that believes in the suppression of all thought, suppression of voices, and is in bed with deep state and the military industrial complex. And so what all these sides do is they all look for common enemies from which to benefit. And so the deep state, and especially the military contractors in America, after the Middle East wars had basically run dry and the American public was sick of them, needed a new target and a new place to kind of go in and make more untold fortune. And so they've shifted their attention from the Middle East and from the war on terror, which quite frankly, most Americans are sick and tired of and exhausted from. Because they didn't, you know, they had a lot of luck in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and then they had some in Libya and then less in Syria, and it was falling apart. Couldn't get it anymore, right? Because Americans were like, we're done with this. We're done with the forever wars, and we're done with paying for wars across the Middle East and Africa. Well, now they created this new big bad boogeyman, which is actually, as we started in the beginning here, the old boogeyman. It's Russia. And so now we're dumping billions upon hundreds of billions of dollars into a war effort that, again, is a new endless war. What's the end game? There is absolutely no end game here.
Yeah, I want to get deeper into kind of this unified interest that you're talking about that's across political barriers and seems to move in between these ideological poles. But before we do that, guys, let me tell you about your absolute moral duty to hire based people through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to talk to you about New Founding. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find employees to get the work done. And that's why you need access to the New Founding Network. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. They're individuals, often in elite organizations, who are ready for a team and mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using the network to hire high-trust, exceptional individuals who match the culture and mission of their team. You can apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll be connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Go there now to find your next hire. All right, Ben. So when we look at the conflict, I think you're absolutely right that guys like Bill Kristol and these other people who are classically supposed to be neoconservatives, be part of that foreign policy establishment on the right, very quickly vacated that position and moved to the center left with no problem. The question I think a lot of people have on their minds is, why is foreign war the centrist position in the United States, be it on the right or the left? Why is that? It seems like the one thing that most people don't want, and yet it's the one thing that, you know, you can just become an ideological chameleon, completely shift all of your priors, as long as you continue to hold to this constant idea of invading different parts of the world whenever the last conflict runs out.
Well, and isn't it so interesting to see how we've moved, especially since, now you're going back to the hippies and those liberals in the 1960s, right? 50s, 60s, 70s, you had a very different group of liberals who were anti-war everything, right? And then you had the more conservatives were pro-military and pro-war. Then all of a sudden we get to somewhere around 20 years ago, and now you're not allowed to be anti-war no matter what. But how does that happen? Well, it happens when you force through your control of media, your control of news and journalism, so that no one's allowed to question anything. As an example, who would you say is the last journalist who's really become famous for challenging war? Now, Good.
Glenn Greenwald, maybe?
Glenn Greenwald? Okay. Yeah. But I would argue that Greenwald followed somebody else named Julian Assange, sure, who was the real journalist who challenged war and actually brought down in many ways the Iraq war and began the kind of descent of the Afghanistan war through what WikiLeaks published. Now, that's controversial because there are a lot of folks out there who would say, well, he's not a journalist. I believe he absolutely is a journalist. But I also believe that more importantly than being a journalist is that Assange was willing to challenge the powerful in a way that corporate media just won't. They won't do it. And so when corporate media becomes bought and paid for by the very people they should be challenging, there is no one to challenge it. And so how does it become the mainstream position, to your question? How does it become the mainstream position to be for foreign interventions everywhere, for endless wars everywhere? For, listen, I've seen articles in the last year that talk about the benefit of a small controlled nuclear war. It would be good for the climate. It could help with climate change. It's like, are these people serious? Who would write that? Who would, first of all, what's a small nuclear war? As if you can control that, as if you have the ability to determine the size of the nuclear weapons that are used and who gets involved. Nuclear war is the end of humanity. That's what it is. If we have a you know, mutual destruction is supposed to be the deterrent to nuclear war. So the idea that you can even play around with terminology like that, who in the CIA is sitting there writing these articles on behalf of the New York Times or on behalf of the Washington Post? So I think that's where we've seen something really incredible happen. I would argue that about 20 years ago, there was a process that began within corporate media, whether it be cable news, broadcast networks, newspapers, where the military and deep state, not actors, you'll hear people talk about like, oh, the CIA back in the 70s through Operation Mockingbird, they would plant people in newsrooms. Okay, I believe that's true. That's declassified documents that prove that that's true. They don't do that anymore. The person from the CIA shows up on CNN and they put a banner across that says Joe Schmo, CIA analyst, or working for the CIA. And he sits and he tells you the CIA's position on this war or on this conflict. And we have become so used to this that Americans will sit and listen and be like, oh yeah, good point, CIA guy, whose entire agency's business is to go around the world to sow discord and to overthrow governments. But we forget that. We act as if, and I think there's also, it sounds a little conspiratorial, but I think there's a purposeful effort that's been made in Hollywood to sanitize that idea and to convince Americans that this is just normal stuff. This is just what we do. And this is actually a patriotic act. What they don't ever talk about when you watch shows like Jack Ryan or you watch movies about this stuff is they never show you what blowback is, right? Where every time the CIA goes in and tries to overthrow a government or leads to a revolution someplace, the consequence of those decisions. You look at a place like Libya where we went and we overthrew Gaddafi for a whole gamut of reasons. And you say, oh, look, we made the world a better place. And yet today in Libya, you can buy human beings in open air slave markets. That is the new Libya that was created as the result of our great democratic interference in that country.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm not constitutionally against war. I think war is part of human nature and it's an unavoidable reality. Pretending that we can never be truly anti-war is kind of a foolish perspective. But I do think there's a consequence for operating a global empire for profit. And it's pretty clear that that's kind of what's been happening here at this point. You know, the yellow journalism getting us into the war is nothing new, that the Hearsts are pretty good at that. But this is something that has become a machine that just seems unstoppable at this point. Now, one of the things I was trying to get into a little earlier was, why Ukraine in particular? Because you said, oh well, these other wars wrap themselves up. We can't find a new reason to stay in Afghanistan or whatever, and so we needed another place to go ahead and funnel military dollars. But is there more to that? Is there something particular about the culture or the way that Ukraine is structured, the corruption there that allows United States companies or officials to go ahead and profit uniquely from Ukraine?
Well, there is actually. So there's a couple of things. Number one, Ukraine, and again, anybody who says before this war, I couldn't have found Ukraine on a map. Well, that's probably true. of most Americans. They didn't even know where it was. And at the same time, they know almost nothing about it. And what most of them would have no idea about is that Ukraine itself was historically, in the last 40 years, and infamously, if not the most, one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. That's not my view of it. That's the United Nations view of it. That's multiple reports that have come out that say, look at the level of corruption in this country. It's run by oligarchs. It was handed over and basically auctioned off to the highest bidder. It is essentially run by gangsters. Now, more recently, we have within the United States a whole lot of political players who have managed to get themselves involved in Ukraine. And that's pretty well documented at this point. We know the Biden family is very entrenched in Ukraine. We know Hunter Biden and his role in Burisma, who was being paid almost $1 million a year to sit on a board for an energy company, and he knew nothing about energy. A lot of people don't know, we go into this in the docuseries, Hunter Biden also invested heavily into a company called Metabiota that ran biolabs in Ukraine and got Pentagon funding to run biolabs in Ukraine. So it's not just one place or two places or three places where the Biden family has business interests in Ukraine. Also, why it's so interesting to me that, you know, I feel like with Trump, one of the things that has happened with him is that Trump will stumble onto something. Not knowingly. I don't think he knows some of this stuff. I think he just goes in. He has no idea how bad it is. And he kicks a hornet's nest. And then all of a sudden, they're all out in the air. And it's like, where did this thing come from? Remember Trump's famous phone call to the president of Ukraine? And it was so controversial. And why was he calling him? He was trying to get dirt on the Bidens. And it became the subject of an impeachment hearing. Right. It becomes such a huge deal. And you say, how did this become this big deal? Well, when you start to dig into Ukraine, you find out Trump stumbled over this nest that was full of corruption. It was full of these backdoor deals and hundreds of millions of dollars swirling around. Also, that's the past. But once you get into the war, it's not just the military. And so one thing we show throughout this series, it's 12 parts long. Each part of this docuseries is looking at a different area. But one thing you're going to find as you follow this with us is that Ukraine is being handed over, right? It's not just about the war. It's the rebuilding effort afterwards. It's the massive global funds that are being set up to administer hundreds of billions of dollars going back into Ukraine and the control of that. Before this war started, the country in the world that had the most IMF debt by far was Argentina. It's why Argentina has the president they have now. It's why Argentina is so famously destroyed as an economy, and the people are in such bad financial shape because they are owned by the IMF. The natural resources of Argentina, the labor of the people, the taxation situation, it's horrific. It's all because the IMF owns them. Well, now, by a long margin, when this war comes to an end, it will be Ukraine, not Argentina, that is owned by the IMF. And so most of the money that's going to Ukraine, when it was first going, we were being told, oh, look, there's money being given from all over the world and European countries that are helping, the U.S. is helping. But then, you know what we're now finding is that a lot of this money is no longer a gift. It's no longer aid. It's a loan. And so instead, it's all being restructured into loans that now the nation of Ukraine and the people of Ukraine will owe for generations. They will owe billions upon, possibly by the time this is all done, trillions of dollars that has to be repaid over lifetimes, not one generation, two generations, but multiple generations. And in I would say that this might sound controversial to you, but I would say that in fact, if you really want to look at who's at war with Ukraine and who just conquered Ukraine, it's multinational corporations. It's not Russia. The real winner, the real entity that has won a war without firing a bullet at the people of Ukraine are multinational corporations that now own that country and will own it into the foreseeable future.
Yeah, this is really nothing new for people who are familiar with, the reconstruction of the American South and westward expansion. This is how the Vanderbilts and the Carnegies and the Rockefellers built their fortunes. Those fortunes didn't just materialize out of thin air. They were built on the backs of war reconstruction expansion, funded by the government. And I would agree that to some extent this is multinational corporations, but I would say there's actually a wider conflict here. There's a bigger network at play. One of the reasons it's so important to fell, I think, Putin, who, again, I'm not a fan of. This is not me shilling for him. He's a terrible person, I'm sure. But one of the reasons it's so important that this guy gets bounced out is that he presents a possibility for a multipolar world. All of these organizations that you're talking about are designed to go ahead and knit our Western ruling managerial elite class into one unified structure that can profit from this kind of thing. They isolate a country like this. They milk it for all it's worth. They do, they distribute the spoils, and this keeps them in charge. And that's why they talk about how we have to fight for democracy, because democracy is just a stand-in word, as it always is, by the way, for oligarchy. And what they're saying is that this country is part of the oligarchic network. So we need to make sure that it stays part of the oligarchic network. The actual freedoms involved with religion or voting or something are immaterial, because when people talk about democracy in the United States or in Ukraine, they're talking about maintaining the oligarchy and the network that runs across many Western nations. And so I was wondering if you could talk about some of the things that most people would probably associate classically with democracy that have been stripped out by Ukraine during this conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's what a great summation that was. So a couple of things. One is absolutely freedom of religion, which I think might be the most surprising to most Americans, right? Because we hold in our country, freedom of religion is such a high priority in terms of determining whether or not a nation actually has freedom or not. What's happened in Ukraine are dozens of priests have been arrested. Ukrainian Orthodox Church, almost called it Greek, Ukrainian Orthodox Church has been shut down effectively. It's allowed to operate only so long as they don't say anything from the pulpit that is deemed to be sympathetic to Russia. Well, what does that include? And the priests, including the head of the church, who we interviewed in this series, by the way, 2 days before he was arrested by Zelensky's forces, they're not allowed to speak out in ways that are supposed to represent, anything that supports Russia. Well, they don't support Russia. In fact, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church specifically broke away from the Russian Orthodox Church 2 years before the war started. And the Ukrainian Orthodox Church actually collectively condemned the war. And yet priests are going to jail. Political parties. In the United States, obviously, we have two major parties. Most people look at that and say, that's a problem. I would be one of those people. But it's pretty common for us, right, to have two major parties. And then obviously we have some smaller parties that don't really have much of a shot because of the way the system is set up. But in most places around the world, that's not the case. In parliamentary systems, you have many, many different parties. Well, Ukraine was one of those countries, had at least 12 different parties operating in Ukraine. Well, one thing that has happened since the war is that Zelensky's come in and banned 11 opposition parties, banned them all. There's one party that has power, and that is the Servant of the People Party, of which he is the head. Zelensky has canceled elections in the country, saying, unless the U.S. gives us more money, we're not even going to bother to hold elections. It's too risky. We're at war. You're just going to remain in power like a dictator and say, we're not going to have an election. Imagine this. Imagine a guy who ran as a peace candidate, was overwhelmingly elected because he said, I won't be at war, now is at war. And because elections are coming, knowing he'll get thrown out, says, well, we're not going to have an election because we can't risk it, right? And the only way we'll have an election is if the U.S. and Europe dump billions more dollars into our coffers before we hold the election. What else? Media. Media is completely under the control of Zelensky's party. Opposition television stations have been shut down, and you're not allowed to broadcast in the country unless you're on an approved channel approved by Zelensky's government giving an approved message. And so we've watched what's happened over there, as I said at the beginning here, happen in a way that we're being told constantly that we have to fund this war because if we don't, democracy will be destroyed. So then we fund the war so that democracy can be destroyed. There is no democracy left in the country, and it's being completely run by this little man in a green suit who walks around dressed for battle constantly and is never, he's never fought anybody, right? He's not part of the war. And yet everywhere he goes, including like the Met Gala, he shows up in a photo shoot for Vogue magazine, and he's dressed as if he's on the front lines. Right. And then he's ringing the bell to the New York Stock Exchange. He's doing all these things. And it's all this persona that's built around this guy who, in fact, is doing every single thing we're being warned that Putin wants to do. He's the one who's actually doing it.
Yeah, it really is an insane amount of kayfabe, but it, I guess, but I have some questions from the people, Ben, if you have enough time to answer a few. Excellent. Well, before we do that, I watched the first episode and it was great. And I know there's going to be, I think, 11 more, you said, coming out. So where can people find these as they start to come out?
Absolutely. So if you go to truthinmedia.com, you can sign up on the email list there and we'll send them to you. The next one is going to come out April 18th, Thursday, April 18th. So I think we're live on this show, right? So if this is live, then it's tomorrow. It'll come out. Will be the second episode. It's called The World's Biggest Celebrity. And it goes into how this guy has managed to become the world's biggest celebrity without having done anything other than lead a war that no one's really sure why he's fighting. But there will be, as I said, very detailed episodes where the weapons are that the U.S. is buying. Where are they headed? Where are they showing up around the world? Because they're not showing up in Ukraine. They're showing a lot of other places. We look at the church. We look at the persecution of the church. We look at the persecution of political opponents. So we're going into great detail on all these issues because, you know, one reason we wanted to do it as a docuseries is it's easy for people to watch like a two-hour documentary and not retain a lot of it. And so we're trying to be very focused in this. Because we believe that at the end of the day, the American people need to know what's going on with this war. We're watching Congress right now is having a battle over whether or not to send more funding to Ukraine. We have a border in the United States that's porous. We know that. Millions upon millions of people are crossing that border. We can't control that, but we keep sending $60 billion at a time to Ukraine. And it's just insane. So go to truthinmedia.com. And then on X, you can follow us at truth_inmedia. We also post there.
Yeah, guys, make sure to check this out. It's really critical. Like you said, you've got guys like Mike Johnson who are basically trying to betray the MAGA movement and the right just so they can go ahead and push more money through to Ukraine and Israel and all these foreign countries while people invade our borders. It's just absolutely insane. People need to be aware of basically the money being stolen and handed to evil people because this can't continue in the United States. It's going to be the suicide of our nation. All right, guys, let's go over to the questions of the people. Creeper Weirdo here says, I don't care if The Rock played a presidential candidate on TV. He'll never be president. Even the attempt will be a zombie Fresh Prince. You know, I feel like the Idiocracy guy, the Camacho macho, you know, guy spraying the machine gun. I wish Zelensky had gone all the way into it. You know, gotten more of that, you know, more of that portrayal, a little more of that character.
He's pretty close. He's pretty close with the outfits that he wears and the beard and all the, I guess, the juice that he's shooting up into the system. Like if you look at Zelensky when the war started and in 2 years, what he looks like now, like he's got to have like trainers working with him. It's all like this costume, this picture surrounding him. One thing that I've learned that was fascinating in this process is Zelensky has an incredible team that was brought in originally from Hollywood to train people around him. To put him in these like 360 green screen situations so that they can make it appear as if he's anywhere in, like in any battle to do his you know video shots from, like a drone strike was just here. It's totally crazy, but the craziest part of it is the fact that we're supposed to watch it with a straight face, and nobody on this side who has any real authority in terms of media and power ever is allowed to question it, or is willing, has the guts to question it and say, guys, come on, this isn't real. Like we're watching a TV show called The Servant of the People. That's what's really happening.
I mean, it's smart. You know, in the United States, we have to listen to Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden pretend like they were under enemy fire, but Zelensky's got the footage. That's a way better system. That's our guys should learn something from these.
Yeah, people. Little VR.
Dayla says, Ukraine isn't a people or a country. It's a zone where criminal activity is the main economy. It's where the corrupt evil come from all over the world to launder the money activity, hence Western support. Actually, I did want to ask you this because I do know people, you know, it's not like Ukrainians are uniformly, you know, Russian, you know, that's not the case or have sympathies towards, you know, so there are many Ukrainians who are, I think, rightly concerned about, you know, the advance of it. What is the situation? Could Ukraine, you know, find itself in a situation where it partitions and the cultural divide for so that there is a people created out of this? Like, what does that look like?
Well, yeah, listen. So I guess one thing I never got to when we were talking earlier about the geographic split of it, we talked a lot about the East, but mm-hmm. Western Ukraine is a people who identify themselves as Ukrainian. A lot of them are closer to being Polish. And there's a lot more Polish background there historically. And so it, basically where you have Kiev, there's a river that runs through the country. And east of that river, right, is identifies more as Russian, and west identifies more as Ukrainian. Here's the amazing thing, though, and to give you an idea like of how people identify. Over the course of this war, you've had about, there were only about 30 million people in Ukraine. About half of the country has left. About 15 million people have left the country and fled the country, which is pretty staggering if you think about that. The majority of people, and you can look this up for yourself, the majority of the people who have left the country, where have they gone? Russia. The number one country that has received people who have left have gone to Russia. Second is, I believe, Poland, and then third is Germany, which are very close. So what you have is you do have an east-west split that's happening in the country right now. People who identify as Russian went to Russia. People who identify more as Ukrainian are in Poland right now, which I know some people who are in Poland. They're not very happy with the fact that there are so many people there. And then going off to Germany as well. And so ultimately, when this war comes to an end, at some point it will come to an end. What will it look like? Well, it's not going to look like Ukraine used to look. From the military experts that we talk to, when we talk to them in this docuseries, they say it on camera. When this thing is over, more than likely, Eastern Ukraine, big chunks of it will belong to Russia. They will be annexed in and they'll belong to Russia. The people will go back into those regions and they'll live there again, but they'll live under Russia's protection. And then more of the western side of Ukraine will become, you know, essentially Ukrainian. But in terms of a map, whatever that map looks like today, that's not what it's going to look like when this thing comes to an end.
Arthur T says, the rationale for supporting Ukraine is constantly a moving target. One week it has to save democracy, then prevent a new Iron Curtain from falling over Europe. Next week it will be stopping Russian colonization of Mars. Yeah, unfortunately, it does feel like there's always a new reason. Though, it's funny, at this point, we used to hear that this war was going to be over in 10 minutes. It was, you know, it was going to be done. You know, you just cut Russia off from the financial system and the whole thing collapses.
Right.
And now it's hard for anyone to even pretend at this point that Ukraine's going to win this. It seems like even our elected officials who are trying to vote them more money have stopped pretending like that's actually going to stop what's happening there. It's just, well, if we could just bleed a few more Russians dry, if we could just fight to the last Ukrainian, that's really the only rationale left.
Right, which is so barbaric if you think about that, right? So our goal is to save Ukraine by killing all the Ukrainians. Our goal is to say the only way we're going to stay until every one of you is dead. It's like, well, who's signing up for that? In fact, who's actually signing up for their military at all? Another story that's not told in this country is the fact that, first of all, when people fled the country, men were not allowed to leave. They were stopped at the border and told, nope, you're going back and you're fighting. They have young men as young as 15 years old being forced into military service, and men as old as 60 years old being forced into military service. And into what service? They have no chance. They can't beat Russia. The U.S. is sending them lots of weapons, but what are we sending them? We're sending them weapons they can't use, and in many cases, they'll get weapons, then Russia will come in, will bomb them, and then take the weapons. So they're losing the weapons that we're giving them. And the weapons that we're paying for, are going to military contractors to build new ones for us. So what's simultaneously happening that never gets talked about is that the U.S. is depleting its own weapon stockpiles to give them away. And who ends up with them? They're either destroyed or Russia's the one who's taking a lot of them in the field of battle. Now, one thing I do want to say, people have asked me, why is this war taking so long? Like, if Russia's so powerful, why aren't they winning? And I've been told the reason for that is because Putin could go in and just carpet bomb everything if he wanted to. And he's choosing not to, because when the war is over, he wants to send all those people from Ukraine who came over to send them back. And you can't send them back if you've destroyed all the homes, all the infrastructure, all the roads, everything. Imagine that, right? The U.S. doesn't fight wars like this. We go into a place, we bomb everything out, and then we send in contractors and we build everybody's stuff. He doesn't want to go back and rebuild Ukraine. So he's taking time to not just lay waste to it so that there's something for people to go back to.
Yeah, it's the difference.
I've been on the ground, but that's what I've heard.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the difference between fighting a war over something you plan to rule as opposed to something you just plan to replace. Paladin YYZ here says, all I want to know is, was Zelensky fairly elected? Meaning, did the people actually vote him as a legitimate candidate?
That's a great question. So our understanding from what we have found is, yes, he was not an illegitimate candidate. But again, he was a very contrived candidate, right? His campaign actually started 2 years before with this TV show. The main oligarch, Igor Kolomoisky, who owns the network that they showed on, the OnePlus1 network, was his major donor, was the one who helped fund his first party, that Servant of the People party, and is still one of his closest advisors. So the whole thing was very choreographed. Did the people fall for it? Absolutely they did. Now, here's a little fact that media won't tell you. Zelensky, before the war started, had been in office for 2 years, right? He was elected in 2019. 2022 is when the war starts, and around February, into February. By the end of 2021, his approval rating was around 23%. He was wildly unpopular in the country. So yes, was he elected? Yes, on two things. One, a peace candidate, and two, that he was gonna stamp out corruption in the country. He did not stamp out corruption. He himself is incredibly corrupt, was taking lots of money, according to the Panama Papers, was buying properties in London, buying properties all over the world. And so he was extremely unpopular. Again, he was polling around 23%. We think Biden's doing bad when he's in the 40th percentile or the 30s. Imagine a president being at 23%, and then the war starts, so the polls don't matter anymore. What people think doesn't matter anymore. And as I mentioned earlier, elections don't even matter anymore.
Right. Creepy Rudo says, but the freedoms, we need to spread the freedoms. And finally, J.H. Snyder says, you're correct about the Hollywood being an arm of the propaganda machine, but 13 Hours does a good job removing the veneer around the U.S. foreign affairs. I haven't seen that movie. I know it's a movie, but I have not seen that one. But thank you for that recommendation, sir. We'll have to check into it. All right, guys, well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. I want to thank Ben so much for coming on. Like I said, I watched that first episode, and I'm looking forward to watching the rest of them, especially the one on where the weapons are going. That one, I think I will find very fascinating. Of course, guys, if it's your first time on this channel, make sure you subscribe, make sure you turn on your notifications, click the bell so you can catch these streams when they go live. If you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, you need to subscribe to the Orin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. And if you'd like to pre-order my book, guys, it comes out in 3 weeks. You can pre-order The Total State on Amazon. Do that now. Thanks for coming by. And as always, I'll talk to you guys next time.